This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a quiet, unannounced, almost furtive ceremony at 10:20 this morning, Baghdad time, U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer handed a letter to Chief Justice Midhat al-Mahmoud, and with it, sovereignty over the state of Iraq. Few Iraqis knew of the transfer until later in the day when members of the interim government, including Prime Minister Ayad Alawi, were sworn in during a live television broadcast. The surprise move came 2 days ahead of schedule in an attempt to thwart insurgents who may have planned attacks to coincide with the scheduled date. After 15 months of war and occupation, a new chapter begins. This is an historical day, a day all Iraqis have been looking forward to, said Iraqi President Ghazi al-Yawar. This is a day we are going to take our country back into the international forum. This hour on Talk of the Nation, we'll talk with a variety of people to find out what this next phase means for the future of Iraq and for ordinary Iraqis whose lives had been turned upside down by the end of the brutal dictatorship and the chaos, uncertainty, and violence that followed. If you have questions about what may happen next in Iraq or about the meaning and limits of this interim government's sovereignty, give us a call. We'd especially like to hear from people who've been to Iraq or have friends and family there. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, TOTN@NPR.org. We start first in Baghdad to get the latest developments. Michael Ware is Time Magazine's Baghdad bureau chief, and thanks for staying up late to speak with us tonight.
That's my pleasure.
The handover is just about 12 hours old now. Walking around Baghdad today, was there any sense of change that was evident?
Well, for me, the most striking sense of change was that it was a relatively quiet day today once it became known that the transition had taken place. This is a Monday in Baghdad. It's the middle of the Arabic working week. The traffic in Baghdad is horrendous these days. There's literally hundreds of thousands of cars that are flooded into roads that cannot cope. Yet this afternoon, you could drive quite quickly to where you want to go. This is about the Iraqi people. The bulk of them who just want to live an ordinary life with their children, who they can send to school, they can go to work, and they can have a security in their homes. They want this government to work. They want any government to work. It's almost at that point, but they're holding their breath. Can this government fulfill the promise with which it's pregnant? And will the insurgents who have become far more daring, far more organized, strike as it is feared? It's already begun, the terrorist attacks on this transition process. Right now we're in a lull. People are waiting to see which way we come out of it.
Well, obviously, one of the reasons given for moving up the handover date was to avoid violence and, I guess, in a sense, steal a march on the insurgents. You've spent a fair amount of time with insurgent groups there in Iraq, especially around Fallujah. You wrote about it in this week's issue of Time magazine. Are the insurgents going to respond with more attacks against an Iraqi government now that the occupation is over?
To the insurgents as they are now, and there's been a significant change in the nature of this enemy to U.S. soldiers. But to these men now, this is not a return to an Iraqi government. This is a handover to an infidel puppet government. It's an apostate government, a government that has lost its faith. It's no more worthy of survival to their minds than the government of President Pervez Musharraf in Pakistan or the governments of Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Jordan, all of whom they've sworn to bring down. This is just another infidel puppet regime. 6-9 months ago, maybe a lot of these insurgents who were fighting like nationalists to just free their country from a foreign occupier might have been sated by a handover to at least a Iraqi government of some sort. No longer. Why? Because the foreign terrorists who have come in here have slowly hijacked the insurgency, won the nationalists to their cause, and now they're fighting holy war. This is jihad now. And the aim of jihad is to bring an Islamic State in Iraq. This is not something these men wanted 6 months ago. They want Sharia law now. In areas of Fallujah where I've been to their safe houses, it's like I'm back with the Taliban in Afghanistan. To these men, June 30 means nothing.
Yet other parts of the insurgency, the militias, for example, loyal to Muqtadir al-Sadr, the Shiite, young Shiite cleric based in Baghdad, they were forming great objections to the massacre of Iraqi citizens last week, more than 100 killed on one day in the coordinated attacks throughout the Sunni triangle.
Yes, look, a lot of people have condemned, if not the attacks, some people will support the attacks, but they condemn the Iraqi victims. The jihadis meet this by saying, as in some videos and propaganda materials they've recently released, mistakes happen in jihad. We call on the faithful to forgive us for this, but it cannot be avoided. And innocent victims of these bombings, not the police, not the contractors, not those who are working with the infidel, but the true innocents of these bombings, go straight to heaven, which for them is always the ultimate goal. So Iraqis dying, I'm afraid that's going to continue. These men want to attack this government, and this government, as it stands right now, is virtually powerless to stop them. The Shia militia of Muqtadir al-Sadr, from the beginning, they were a house of cards. They were a popular uprising in slums by young men with little to no military experience who were just cut down by the dozen. The real military skill, the military expertise, the institutional knowledge of the Iraqi military lies in the Sunni heartland. That's where Saddam came from. That's who he supported. That's who supported him. They were the commanders. The weapons and the knowledge has gone back with them. Now they're joined by foreign terrorists, professionals, many of them. It has changed this war from a counterinsurgency to a full-blown face-to-face confrontation with jihad, the very jihad Osama bin Laden hoped to inspire with September 11th. We're going in circles.
And let me ask you one final question, Michael Ware. It is now the political task of Prime Minister Alawi to establish some form of authority and at the same time make sure that he does not appear to be a stooge of the United States. It's going to be a very difficult line to dance.
Oh, it very much will be. And, I mean, his appointment, to some degree, was greeted by the bad guy propaganda machine. Prime Minister Alawi, it is no secret, he's spoken openly about his past involvement with the CIA. And he, when he returned to Iraq, remained supported and backed by the CIA, while the Department of Defense backed others and other agencies backed other people. It is known that he was involved in CIA activities throughout the 90s. He was opposing Saddam. He wanted to bring down a dictator who he was had made an oath to defeat. So he was taking to friends where he could find them. But to the bad guys, to the rest of the Islamic world, this is a CIA stooge. You've made him prime minister. It opens them up to that kind of criticism. But the ordinary Iraqi, they look beyond that. They just want a man who can bring order. With order can come investment and commerce and a re-flourishing of the society they once had, which they've now lost. People spend their nights sitting in their homes when they used to be out, mixing, socialising with their friends, going to restaurants. The flavour of the city just isn't here at the moment, especially not at night. They're hoping that this Prime Minister can bring that back.
Michael Ware, again, thanks for staying up, and we appreciate your time this evening.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Ware, Time Magazine's Baghdad Bureau Chief. He joined us from Baghdad. Also on the line with us from Baghdad is Ahmad al-Rakabi. He's the founder of Iraq's first independent talk radio station. It's called Radio Dishla. Dishla is the Arabic word for tigris, as in the river. He opened the station just 2 months ago. He's been broadcasting from a house in Baghdad for about 18 hours every day. Ahmad al-Rakabi joins us on the phone from his office. And again, we thank you for staying up late at night.
Well, thanks for having me.
And what have people been saying as they called in to speak on Radio Dishla today?
Well, Radio Dishla was like a birthday party place today. We had hundreds of phone calls since the announcement of the handover was made about 11 o'clock this morning, almost half an hour after the official handover took place in a very small meeting. People were calling and congratulating each other greeting each other and hoping to see a good future in the for Iraq. They were all wishing also to, almost begging the terrorists and the insurgents to take a day off today and not to disturb the joy of the people. So I could tell you it was a very happy day today.
So at least based on the reactions of your callers, people did see this as a significant moment.
Well, it seems so. And I must say that they were happy to have the sovereignty, but they were also very grateful, or at least some of the listeners were very grateful to what the U.S. did in Iraq. I remember one caller, she was saying that we would like to thank Mr. Bremer and the American people for helping us to get rid of Saddam, and I wish Mr. Bremer a safe journey home. We had all kind of opinions, but definitely they were all opinions of happy people, joyful people. Now, we don't know whether they believe that the sovereignty took really place. I mean, at least the political sovereignty happened today. But you could still, I mean, even though it was a very, very special day in Baghdad today, the traffic was perfect. For the first time, I had a sense of a normal life in Baghdad today, but you could still see American tanks under the bridges, and in some areas, you could still see American helicopters in the air. Probably, I mean, until Iraq has an army, a real army, you will still see American soldiers and coalition soldiers around.
Certainly up till now, the Iraqi, the major problems for most people in Iraq have had to deal with, well, certainly security, but also lack of electricity, clean water, sewer problems. Do people anticipate that these are going to get it better now after a handover of power?
Well, there is some optimism that things will get better in the near future, hopefully. But I think that after a while, probably today they're happy and tomorrow they will be happy as well. But maybe next week we'll hear different opinions. We will hear about people complaining that nothing happened yet and it doesn't. There's no big difference between yesterday and today. So it will take them some time to realize that things are different because the person who was unemployed last week and who will remain unemployed for the next 2 weeks or for the next month, I don't think that this handover will mean a lot for him. So until he gets a job, I think that's a real handover for him. So is the case for all people suffering from the power failures in Baghdad and other problems such as, again, unemployment or sewage or environmental problems. But I believe that the current government is going to focus at the moment on the security issue. Today there was reports that Zarqawi was arrested. General Mark Kemet denied this report. But there was a very strange reaction from the Iraqi officials on this issue. We have noticed, or journalists who spoke to the Prime Minister, Riyad Alawi, on the issue of Zarqawi. They had a very, very strange answer that, let's not talk about this issue today. We will talk about it in the next 2 days. And so was the answer from the Minister of Interior. So there is a feeling here that Zarqawi, despite the statement...
Mr. Al-Rakabi, here's a question for Talk Radio. We're going to ask you to hang on till after the break to finish your answer. We'll be back with more in just a minute. This is Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Iraq is a sovereign nation today, 2 days earlier than expected. We're talking about what lies ahead for the interim government and the Iraqi people. If you have questions about what may happen next in Iraq or about the meaning of Iraqi sovereignty, Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN, at npr.org. Right now we're speaking with Ahmad Al-Rakabi, who's the founder of Radio Dijla, a live talk radio program broadcasting in Baghdad and the surrounding area. Just before the break, he was telling us how the government is expected to concentrate on security before it goes on to perhaps deal with the other issues of electricity and all the other garbage pickup and potholes and cleaning the streets and getting the traffic to run properly. And Ahmed Al-Rakabi, in a way, aren't all of those issues, and particularly the economy, tied to security?
Well, of course, there is a very strong connection between the security issue and the improvement of the economic situation in this country. There are many companies, foreign companies, waiting to invest in Iraq. But, of course, with all these kidnappings and all this suicide attacks, many are reluctant to enter this country and start to invest. So definitely starting to focus on the security issue will bring a lot of things, a lot of good things with it, because the terrorists are also attacking the power stations. And this is affecting the daily life of the Iraqis in a bad way. Nowadays, the heat is terrible in Baghdad. There are people dying, not necessarily of the car bombs, but the heat is enough to kill a number of people every day. And the lack of electricity and the lack of air conditions in many places is causing a lot of problems, serious problems for the people. Plus, many industries and many small businesses are affected by this fact. Dealing with the security issue and finding solutions for it will bring a lot of good things for the life of the Iraqis. Until now, Iraqis were deprived from any kind of normal life. So I think the government will do the right thing by focusing on the security issue first. And by the way, we had a number of opinion polls here made in Radio Dijla. We have noticed that the majority of the Iraqis actually do support curfews. They do support even martial laws. They support anything which could help the security in this country because they are fed up. It's about 14 or 15 months of a terrible life. They were deprived for a very long time from any sense of normal life. So I think this government, and for the first time I noticed that the government in Iraq share the same goals of the people. It never happened before. So I feel that people are willing to give this government a chance to do its job. And I noticed that there was an amazing cooperation between people in the street and the security forces today. The security forces today, the Iraqi police, were showing an unusual activity, and they, I believe they are working with zero tolerance. And I didn't see anyone angry or irritated because of that. On the contrary, if the police didn't search you properly, you would tell them you didn't do your job properly. I would like you to search me again. So it's a bit unusual, but I think that for the first time, people do feel that this government has to do with them, and it could bring something good for them. So they will wait. But also we have a problem in this country. We tend to forget things very quickly, even though Saddam Hussein was ruling with fear in this country for 35 years, even though he was a dictator for a long time. It seems like we forgot all this, even though we have much better life nowadays. But still, we are complaining, and we're not realizing until now that we got a better life. There are electricity problems in Baghdad. That's true. But in the days of Saddam, Baghdad had electricity, but most of the Iraqi provinces were deprived from electricity. A province like Nasiriyah didn't see electricity almost only for 2 hours a day, probably. But nowadays, it's about 18 or 17 hours a day. So there is improvement in Iraq, actually. good things are happening, but unfortunately, the media is only focusing on bad things. Now, there is also a belief, which I believe is a misunderstanding.
Mr. Arakavi, I have to say thank you very much for your time. We've got to move on to another guest. But I wish you good luck with your radio station, and I hope we can talk to you again in the future.
Thank you very much.
Ahmad Al-Rakabi is the founder of Iraq's first independent talk radio station called Radio Dijla, and he spoke to us from his office in Baghdad. And joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Don Gagne. He's in Istanbul, Turkey, traveling with President Bush, attending the NATO summit in Istanbul. And Don, thanks very much for your time.
Hi, Neil. Glad to be here.
So what is the administration, what are the American officials there in Istanbul say about why the date was moved up to today, the transfer date?
They're saying that it was time, that the Iraqis were ready. They'd already handed over control of the various ministries within the new Iraqi government. The president said that they'd always said it would be by June 30th, not necessarily right on June 30th, and that Prime Minister Alawi had asked for this. So they worked with him, and they could make it happen. They do have a sense here that they proved the cynics wrong who said it wouldn't happen or that it would have to be delayed. Now, the other part of it, though, is they certainly had worries about June 30th and what might happen that day, what the insurgents might have planned or what they might have tried to do to disrupt things. The handover on that day might have come amid explosions and other attacks timed to coincide with it. As it is now with this surprise announcement, the handover really does get a day as the focus of the story, a day of good news, a day when the administration is focusing on the positive and how different Iraq is now compared to what it was like under Saddam Hussein. And just quickly, from a news perspective, they don't have to share the story with whatever bad might have been planned.
Yet no one expects the insurgency to go away. President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair of Great Britain also spoke about the insurgents there in Istanbul earlier today.
They did indeed. They both talked about it in that news conference that they had. President Bush talked about the insurgents' effort to break the will and the commitment of the U.S. and other countries. And he went into this thing about some of the really gruesome images we've been seeing on television. And I'll read a quote from the president here. He said, "It's tough. There's no question about it." He says, "Look, they can't whip our militaries. What they can do is get on your TV screens and stand in front of your TV cameras and cut somebody's head off in order to try to cause us to cringe and retreat. That's their strongest weapon." And he said, "Prime Minister Alawi won't give in to that, and he will not cower in the face of such brutal murders, and neither will we." Those are the words of the president. And Prime Minister Blair talked about it as well, emphasizing that those behind the violence in Iraq, those behind the bombings and the kidnappings will not win, but that it's important that the rest of the world be as clear in its mission and its need to succeed in Iraq as the insurgents certainly are in theirs.
Did the president or the prime minister talk about the possibility of some of those measures against the insurgents, including the possibility of martial law imposed by this interim Iraqi government?
They were both asked about that at the news conference, and the president's line was that Prime Minister Alawi will make the choice and he will do what he needs to do for the good of his country to provide security for his country, and it could indeed include this. Now, the question becomes, what will the U.S. military's role be in that? Because that is, in effect, the security force there now, and the president said there'll be consultations, but he basically said it will be Alawi's call. Blair had kind of another take on it. He said if Alawi imposes martial law, he said, "Do not think of it as taking the freedoms of Iraqis away because of all that martial law means." He said if he puts it in place, it will be temporary, only to address what is an extraordinary situation. And again, he stressed it will be temporary. It'll only be to deal with these threats that are there now. And ultimately, it would be there so that the freedoms can flourish and ultimately be restored. So that was Blair's take on it.
Don Gagne, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
NPR White House correspondent Don Gagne joined us from Istanbul, Turkey, where he's traveling with the president, who's attending the NATO summit. Well, we come back here to Washington for two perspectives on Iraq, one on political and civilian changes taking place, the other on military and security situation. Joining us now on the phone from his office here in Washington, John Alterman, director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Good to have you back on the program.
Good to be with you again.
And also with us here in Washington is Robert Malley, director of the Middle East Program at the International Crisis Group here in Washington, D.C. Good of you to be with us again.
Thank you.
He's also the author of a paper for the ICG called Iraq Building a New Security Structure. And let me begin with you, Robert Malley. Security is issue number one. And as you look ahead towards the situation in Iraq, is this Iraqi government going to be able to put an Iraqi face on a terrible security situation?
Well, that's obviously the challenge. It's been the challenge for a long time, and now with the symbolic transfer of sovereignty, it's become even more so. But frankly, the problem that we identified in the report several months ago remain. This is a government that is relying almost entirely on foreign forces for its own survival and for the stability of its country, yet it needs to put an Iraqi face, as you say, on the security structure. Otherwise, its own legitimacy will be quickly undermined. And it's facing a series of catch-22s of that order, showing more independence, yet having to rely on the U.S., needing to have more police, yet needing more time to train the police because they've been ineffectively trained so far, needing to employ tough tactics, yet these tough tactics are precisely the ones that give more support for the insurgency. So it's not going to be an easy task by any means, and unfortunately we're starting from point zero, if not negative.
John Alterman, let me ask you, as much as the security situation obviously is important, so is symbolism important, too. The transfer of power, this was an almost furtive handover of power. And what's happening inside the Green Zone, the former presidential palace of Saddam Hussein that's been used as headquarters by the CPA, the American-led provisional authority?
Well, the Green Zone has a large number of buildings. It's almost like the mall area in Washington. It's really a district. And the Americans are pulling out of the buildings where the CPA had been administering Iraq in a symbolic shift to show that it isn't the way it used to be, that when people need to go to get decisions, they don't go to where Jerry Bremer used to sit, but they go somewhere else. But the fact is that a lot of power in Iraq is going to remain concentrated in the Green Zone. And what the Iraqi government is going to have to do, as Rob suggested, is on the one hand, be sure to show your independence from Americans, say this is not only an Iraqi face, but these are Iraqis making decisions for our own future, while still being able to draw all the support that the Americans have to give in terms of money and technical assistance and military backup and all those sorts of things. My sense is to do the first, they're going to have to stand up to the Americans, but they can't stand up so much that they alienate the Americans because then they'll lose the second.
We're talking about today's transfer of sovereignty in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a listener involved in the conversation. Dennis joins us from Somerset, New Jersey.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon.
I noticed that your guests have several times referred to this as a symbolic transfer of sovereignty. I'm wondering that in spite of the fact for weeks leading up to this, President Bush has said this would be a total transfer of sovereignty. I understand Paul Bremer has put in place several changes to the Iraqi code and several appointees that will limit the sovereignty that the country has. And I'm curious why, in all the hoopla of today, the president seems to be getting a pass on this.
Well, John Alterman?
I didn't say it's merely symbolic. I think it will be more than symbolic.
I think I talked about the importance of symbols. But
the symbols are very important, but I don't know how to define sovereignty. It's one of those words, and once you start modifying sovereignty and talking about complete sovereignty, I know even less what it means. What has to happen is that Iraqis have to feel what Iraqis haven't felt for the last 15 months, which is we're really in charge of our own destiny. And one of the greatest failings of the CPA has been not being able to engender that feeling among Iraqis. One of the things that Iyad Alawi has been very, very successful at in 3 weeks is presenting an Iraqi face of an Iraqi leadership of the country. And that's a very, very important thing to do.
Yet, what about all of the Dennis's question about all of the regulations and orders, excuse me, and that sort of thing that were put out by the CPA? Robert Malley, is that going to be an issue of sovereignty raised there? These are American orders.
It certainly could be, just like the temporary administrative law, which is kind of a temporary constitution, which was passed during the U.S. occupation. And they're supposed to last at least until the elections, and in some cases beyond that. Those are going to be real questions for Iraqis who are going to feel that decisions were made behind their backs and that have a life that go beyond the mandate of the occupation. I think on all these issues, this is a point I think John is just hinting at, in order for the Iraqi government and therefore for our interests to prevail, we, the United States, are going to have to suffer some defeats. In other words, the more it looks like Alawi and his government are making decisions that go against what we would have preferred, though not necessarily against our interests, their legitimacy will be strengthened, and therefore the whole enterprise has a greater chance of success. And it may mean overturning some of the decisions that were taken at the last minute by Paul Bremer in order to enshrine principles that we believe in, but Iraqis may not.
Dennis, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. I wanted to ask you both, we just have a couple of minutes left in this segment, and then we'll take more questions after the break. But I did want to ask you about the issue of as you look at the situation there in Baghdad and the prospects for this new government. Obviously, security is issue number one. But John Alterman, if they can't improve the economic situation, these things are intertwined utterly.
The security, the economics, and the political progress are all intertwined. But where Iraqis are really hurting, and where Iraqis are really willing to make compromises in terms of freedom is to get the security situation under control. They talk about, in poll after poll, we want democracy, but they really want democracy in 5 years. They're willing to take authoritarian leadership in the short term just so it's safe to leave your house.
And Robert Malley, the situation there, of course, and again, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to answer a complicated question. Who's in control of military forces in Iraq? Clearly, the United States and its allies are insisting on a great deal of autonomy.
Well, certainly, the multinational forces under U.S. command and the Iraqi forces should be under Iraqi command. The real question, the real test is going to be if the U.S. wants to take major military action that the Iraqi government opposes, will they do it anyway, or will they have the wisdom, in my view, of saying, well, it's the Iraq's future, and if we take action that they object to, we lose and they lose.
We'll have more with Robert Malley of the International Crisis Group here in Washington and with John Alterman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies when we come back from the break. And more of your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send questions by email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Iraq, a transfer of sovereignty, our guests are Robert Malley, director of the Middle East Program at the International Crisis Group in Washington, D.C., and John Alterman, director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And let's get another caller on the line. This is John, who's with us from Shaker Heights, Ohio.
Yes, Neil. In my view, Sheikh Ali Sistani is the ultimate power in Iraq. He represents the 60% majority of Shiites. He's played a very cagey role in not meeting with Mr. Bremer and also with the United Nations representative, not legitimizing them and also allowing the United States actually to deal with rivals to his rule. My question is, has Mr. Alawi gotten a meeting with Ali Sistani? And the second question is, as in light that his work has been called poor and amateurish by his contemporaries, why is John Yoo still allowed to be on your program?
Okay, thank you, John. John Alterman, let me put the question about Ali Sistani to you.
One of the interesting things that I'm seeing among Iraqi clerics is the different kinds of roles they're talking about in the future of their country. There was a fear in 1991 that if there were a successful Shia uprising in the south, that Iran would move in and Iraq would become another Iran. And what we're seeing Ali Sistani and others do is really carve out a different role for clerics, a role in which clerics don't rule the country, but clerics have a voice in the country. Muqtada Sadr, the rebel from the south of the country, is trying a different role. I think he's ultimately going to be less successful. And Ali Sistani is, along with many of his followers, trying to carve out a different influential but certainly not a ruling role in the country.
John, let me ask you, Robert Malley, we talked about obviously the bind that the Iraqi forces are in, having to take a lot of authority without having the time to train up their forces. What is the state of Iraq's security forces right now?
Well, I mean, they obviously are both understaffed and undertrained at this point. And the main what we're talking about really is the police, because they're the ones who are going to have to get a grip on the security situation. And they're the ones who have not been adequately trained and whose training, I mean, it's very difficult because trainers don't want to come to Iraq to train them, so they're trained outside in either Jordan or the United Arab Emirates. And then when they come back, they're thrown into an environment where there's no follow-on to the training, so there's no feedback to know whether the training they got was adequate. So there's not enough training, it's too short, and it's not adapted. But all of this is just a function of the very difficult security situation in the country, and the fact that until now there was no legitimate government to whom the police or other security forces could really pledge loyalty. So all the politics and the security have to go hand in hand, but right now we don't have an Iraqi security force that's capable of taking care of its country.
Let's get another question in. Jessica from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Hi there. I had a quick question. My brother is a Marine, and he has already been to Iraq, and he's about to go back again. And I was curious as to why he was going back again if we had just handed over sovereignty to the Iraqis.
Robert Malley, U.S. forces are going to be in Iraq for quite some time to come, aren't they?
Yes, and first my heart goes out to you, and I hope I wish him well. Certainly, I think what's happened, there was an underestimation from the beginning of how many troops would be needed and for how long. And we're now seeing that people who were supposed to leave have to stay. People who left have to be brought back. And in fact, we're thinking of a spike, to have less people not leave in time and their replacements coming, so that over the next few months and by the end of the year, we'll have more soldiers there than ever before. As I said, there are no Iraqi forces right now that are capable of ensuring the security of their country. But again, it's one of those paradoxes, because more and more Iraqis are telling me that American forces are the magnet for insurgent hostile actions. So you need them there, but having them there does compound the problem to some extent.
Jessica, we wish, would you relay our best wishes to your brother?
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And John Alterman, let me end with a question for you. In the immediate days ahead, particularly with the possibility of insurgent attacks later in the week, what do you think the first task is for the new prime minister of Iraq?
The first task is to really establish himself as the leader of the country. I think the fact that this handover ceremony wasn't not only broadcast with pomp and circumstance, it wasn't broadcast live to the Iraqi people, suggests just how many security problems, just how unsure people are. He's going to have to come out and ultimately risk his security to show that he's not afraid to visit with the Iraqi people, to be a visible Iraqi leader who's really in touch with the people, who's in touch with the country, and is ready to lead the country forward into a much bolder and better future than it's had in the past.
John Alterman, thanks very much.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
John Alterman, Director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Robert Malley, as always, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Robert Malley, Director of the Middle East Program at the International Crisis Group. They both spoke with us from their offices here in Washington. As it approaches midnight in Iraq, we want to go back there one more time to hear about how today's surprise transfer of authority is being received by Iraqis. Joining us now from his home in Karbala, a city some 60 miles south of Baghdad, is Syed Hossein Kazwini. He returned to his native country after living the past 15 years here in the United States. And good of you to join us here on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, sir. It's a pleasure to be on.
You were born in Iran, where your parents fled from Saddam Hussein's regime. You've lived in California since you were 7 years old. You're 22 years old now. Why did you decide to go back to Iraq?
Sir, there's plenty of reasons why I decided to come back. First of all, I felt there was a need as an Iraqi-American. There's a need for us to come back, especially for the reconstruction process. If people like myself don't come back to help, who will, really?
I understand you graduated from Berkeley in May.
Yes, sir.
And got married last Friday?
Yes, my wedding was last Friday, and I'm enjoying my first days of marriage with my wife.
Congratulations to you on both.
Thank you very much, sir.
And what do you plan to do in the immediate future?
Sir, I have lots of goals. I have short-term goals. I have long-term goals, along with my father, Ayatollah Qazwini. We've established a relief organization by the name of Development and Relief Foundation here in Karbala, which houses an orphanage as well as a school for the orphans here in Karbala. Currently, only in the city of Karbala, we have 25,000 orphans. Most of these children became orphans in the year 1991 when Saddam Hussein obliterated thousands of young men in the south due to the uprising, the Shiite uprising in the south.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these young men left thousands of orphans, which we like to look after. We also established a university along with our cousin, Dr. Mehsin Qazwini, by the name of Ahlul Bayt International University, which has about 500 students enrolled. This process of having educating the youth, educating the people here. Saddam Hussein did a wonderful job in suppressing the people, especially in the field of in academics and education. We're trying to educate these people.
And let me ask you briefly, what was it like in Karbala today after word of the transfer of sovereignty began to circulate?
Majority of the people are very happy. They're very happy to hear this news. They're very optimistic of the future. We're finally glad to see that there's a democratic institution in the process taking place here. The country has been repressed for the past 35 years. It faced dictatorship for the past 35 years. And to be honest, there hasn't been true democracy in this country for the past century. And so this is definitely a good step towards democracy. However, I must say that people have a lot of concerns.
We'll discuss those in just a moment. We're talking about the transfer of sovereignty in Iraq today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And if the name Qazwini sounds familiar, well, we have spoken several times over the past few years with Imam Sayed Mustafa al-Qazwini, the older brother of Sayed Hossein Qazwini. And Sayed Hossein Qazwini is on the line with us from Karbala, but Imam Sayed Mustafa al-Qazwini is on the line with us now from California. Good to speak with you again.
Glad to talk to you, Neil. Good afternoon, and very happy to hear my newlywed brother speaking from Karbala.
Were you able to be there for the wedding?
Unfortunately, I could make it, but I'm planning to go in the near future.
How did you feel when your brother Hussein told you he was going back to Iraq to live?
In fact, I was worried about him, not only about him, about my entire family and the Iraqi people, since you can see the escalation of violence on a daily basis in Iraq. People really, most of them are unhappy about that. But however, I knew that he is going for a good cause. He is going to contribute into the building of the infrastructure, especially the educational, cultural, spiritual infrastructure of that nation. So everyone has to sacrifice, I think.
Hossein was telling us a little bit about what it was like in Karbala today about the transfer of sovereignty. What was it like in Southern California?
I think it's a historic day for Iraqis inside and outside Iraq. People here are jubilant, but let's be honest and say that it's really not the transfer of the real sovereignty to the people of Iraq. A real sovereignty comes when the Iraqis will be able to have real power over their fate. But until the Americans are there and they continue to have a great military and economic sway and a presence in Iraq, I don't think we can call it a real sovereignty. However, this is the first step into receiving the sovereignty, obtaining the sovereignty, and establishing a democratic state where all the Iraqis can enjoy equality, freedom, and respect.
Let me talk to your little brother there in Karbala there just a moment. You were saying just a moment ago that people have real concerns the sovereignty issue that your elder brother was talking about? Was that what you were referring to?
Yes, Neil. People here have lots of concerns. Number one, there's a lack of jobs. The rate of just people without jobs is unbelievable, especially here in the south, specifically in the city of Kabla. I can easily say that about anywhere from 40 to 50% of the people are left without jobs. And this is something normal. It's common sense that if you're left without a job, if you don't have a salary, you will have to go through illegal means in obtaining some bread to bring to your family. And that's why that's why the rate of crimes are so high, and that's why we have insurgents. These people are being paid by foreign sources and by previous members of the Ba'ath Party, and they're performing these acts of terrorism, targeted assassinations, explosions in police stations, targeted assassinations against politicians, college professors, religious leaders, regular citizens. Lack of jobs is the first concern. The second concern is obviously the issue of security. People are afraid to go out of their homes. I would like to go to Baghdad, but I'm afraid. I'm afraid to go to Baghdad because at any moment an explosion could go off, a bomb could go off. We hear on the news every day of explosions going off. The third concern, electricity. We barely have any electricity. Currently, we only have 12 hours. And, of course, Iraq is basically in the middle of the desert. Especially in the summer, the summers are extremely hot. And without air conditioning, people can go crazy, literally. Mm. Electricity is not enough. We don't understand why the coalition forces are not providing electricity. We don't understand why they're not providing gas and fuel. Many of the taxi drivers here complain to us about long lines at gas stations.
In a country which, of course, is the second largest reserves of oil anywhere in the world. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I wanted to thank you both very much.
Absolutely. Right after Saudi Arabia, Iraq is the second oil-rich country.
Yes,
the people do not have gas and fuel. They don't have access. Where is it going?
And I have to thank both of the Al-Kazwini brothers, Imam Sayed Mustafa Al-Kazwini from Los Angeles, his brother Sayed Hussein Kazwini from Karbala, Iraq. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News.